Call the next case. You may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is John Maines. I appear on behalf of the appellant Donald M. Devine, Jr. In this case, on November 21st, 2013, judgment was entered against my client, which by my calculation came to $1,059,704.07. That judgment was entered in a case which spoke to an accusation that my client had made misrepresentations regarding a sill that was in a 200-and-some-year-old house, a sill which was deteriorated and which, according to the appellee's evidence, would cost $46,821 to repair. And so I would submit to the court that the first question it would ask is, how do we go from a $46,000 repair to a $1 million-plus verdict? And I would submit to you, there are several errors in this case, but three that jump out immediately to the court is, number one, what the plaintiffs did is they turned a breach of contract into a tort. And this court has many times said we are not to do that. The court has said that in the Augusta Mutual Insurance case, of course, the Richmond Metropolitan case, and also in the case of Dunn versus Clonia. And the way that the plaintiffs did that is they complain in paragraph 12 of their second amended complaint that my client did not tell them the source of moisture that was coming into the house that stained a living room ceiling. When they themselves admit in their complaint that the misrepresentation goes to a breach of contract, and there was an amendment to the contract which specifically required that my client determine the source of moisture, and I will submit to you that he did not. I will submit to you that what he did is he allowed his real estate agent, along with her handyman, to address the issue because he is out of town. He's 107 miles away. He's letting them handle it. Now, why questions weren't presented to the handyman and the real estate agent, when you open that ceiling, what was the source of moisture, that's going to have to be something that
If your client, through his agent, represented to the buyers that it was caused by the storm, that they had investigated the damage, it was still found to be caused by the storm and it had been repaired, why wouldn't that be a fraud?
Because again, it goes to a duty that the plaintiffs themselves have identified was contractual in nature, which is identify the source of moisture. That was in the addendum.
The duty was to identify the source of moisture. The response back is it was caused by a storm when arguably your client knew that it was not. Why isn't that a concealment that takes it out of the breach of contract?
Because according to the Augusta Mutual case and the Richmond Metropolitan case, you look to the genesis of the duty. And in this instance, that duty is part of a written contract.
They also argue that they were further induced to then close on the property by that misrepresentation. So why wouldn't that be a fraud?
Because, again, you're talking about the completion of a contract. In the Dunn case, what happened there, and indeed in the Richmond Metropolitan case, what happened there, is that allegedly misrepresentations were made with respect to the course of construction in order to induce the completion of the contractual obligation, which in those instances, and in this instance, were the transfer of money. The other rule of law that I believe was ignored in this case is a very fundamental rule, which is if you are going to allege fraud, you have two options available to you according to the law of the Commonwealth. You can seek rescission or you can seek to sue in damages. And what has happened in this case, and there's two cases, again, the Augusta Mutual case spoke to that, as did, I believe, the Robert Trek versus Maitland case. But what happened in this case is that the plaintiffs combined the two. They sought rescission, and they also asked for consequential damages, in which would be available, if at all, in a legal fraud claim, not in a rescission. And then the last rule of law that was ignored, and this is a rule of law, again, that has been addressed by this court many, many times. If a plaintiff is going to complain of being defrauded and as a result of that fraud purchasing real estate, the damages, if they're going to seek damages, those damages are limited to the difference between the value of the property as represented and the value of the property that was received. And in this instance, there was no effort by the plaintiffs at all to put on that evidence. They did not put on that evidence. And in the Bershader case, the court said, you have to do this. And in that case, the plaintiffs tried to backdoor repair damage or replacement damage evidence by having an appraiser come in and say that their difference in the value was $34,000 because that's what it would cost to get these trees in that had been taken down. And this court said, no, we're not going to do that. You have to present evidence in terms of the difference in value if you're going to seek damages, and that did not occur here.
In Millboro Lumber, as the law we stated, however, equity deals with substance and not form and will grant such relief as far as possible by allowing compensation. Why wouldn't that case be read for the proposition that, yes, you can seek rescission and the consequential damages that flow from the fraud that make them whole, the whole notion being to make them whole?
Because, again, I think what you're doing is you are doing something that this court has said in many, many cases. You're not going to combine the rescission, and I'll talk about the Millsboro case in a minute. You're not going to combine the equitable remedy of rescission with the legal remedy of damages. In the Millsboro case, I would submit to you that the damages that were awarded there, that were above and beyond the purchase price, were profits that, as I understand the opinion, were received by the defendant from the plaintiff because of a side service agreement that they entered into. And essentially, those were restitutionary damages. The plaintiff was asking for all money back that it had given to the defendant, and I have no problem with that. But when you go and ask for compensatory damages, or consequential damages, or special damages, or punitive damages in a rescission case, I don't think you can do that. And there's no case, and I've read a lot of cases in preparation for today, a lot of rescission cases, a lot of fraud cases. I have not seen, and I've not seen in opposing counsel's brief, any case which says that we are going to combine the equitable remedy of rescission with the legal remedy of damages. As a matter of fact, I believe that the court has often said, because the remedy of rescission is such an extraordinary remedy, that in most instances we will leave the plaintiff to his remedy at law for damages and not permit rescission. Now, with respect, that, of course, leaves the issue of rescission. And I did want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, so I'll be very brief here. The case for rescission that was advanced by the plaintiffs, again, I think fails because they relied on a breach of contract theory, number one.
Let me ask another question about that, counsel. You've addressed the window damage. What about the concealed sill damage? Why wouldn't that entitle them to rescission?
There are multiple reasons with respect to the concealment argument. First and foremost, I believe that when this court has looked at concealment issues in the past and have allowed the recovery of legal damages or rescission, the concealment consisted of the defendant placing things to hide conditions, things that weren't there before. And in this particular instance, for example,
they place a rug over it, they put furniture out in front of it, they light a fire,
in the concrete. The siding was always there. Nothing new.
Well, this siding wasn't always there.
Siding was always there. And let me address that issue very quickly. If it was somehow nefarious for my client to replace siding. And, well, if that were true, then I think during the course of their investigations, the plaintiffs, who, it must be remembered, my client was never present at any of their inspections. Their agent left because she thought it would be improper for her to be there. There was nothing that diverted these people or kept them from asking questions. And in the Avon case, there was a sign of roof repair. And this court suggested when there was a sign of a repair, a change, then the plaintiff there should have asked the owner or the tenants of the owner, why did you repair this? And there was no request along those lines by the defendants. And let me very quickly add, if we take the placement of siding as a nefarious act of concealment, it still does not get the plaintiffs to where they want to be because of the lack of reliance. Because what they have alleged over and over and over is, you promised us that this property was restored. And their own inspections show that the property was not restored, that the silt that they complain of was not restored.
But can't we separate the issue of the brochure which says completely restored from the issue of siding over damaged sills that obviously whoever put the siding there knew there was no sill there to put the siding over? So can't we separate the issue of the representation in the brochure, which they may or may not have reasonably relied on, from the active concealment under the sill, which you wouldn't expect them to pull off the siding and look under the sill?
Okay.
Or the sill.
Two quick answers. First of all, under Poe versus Voss, in a number of cases since then, this court has said that if you see something that puts you on notice that further investigation needs to be undertaken, and you don't undertake that investigation, that is going to be your problem under caveat emptor.
And I can assume that the trial court nor the commissioner, while they found it suspicious, didn't think that it necessarily put these parties on notice and didn't really put either of their inspectors on
and
notice.
And I think that that was an error of law on both of their parts. I think that there are multiple cases, again, that say if you conduct an investigation, and it must be remembered, in this particular instance, one of their own inspectors said, we have found damage in this area. You should have this examined by a contractor.
That wasn't the same area, was it, counsel? They were talking about the sill in the basement with the water and bug infestation damage.
I think that they were saying that there was damage to the sill and because of water and insect damage, and that inspector said because of that damage, you should have a contractor, which they ultimately ended doing, but too late for them, to inspect it, and they decided not to. I have 2 minutes left, so absent any further questions, I will.
All right.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. I'm Dave Bug from Irvington, and I would like to jump right into addressing a point that you raised. When these folks signed this contract, there was an addendum that said they have a right to inspect. They employed that right. They had two inspections, and there was also the bit about the ceiling. Now, if they had had an inkling as to what was really going on with the ceiling and where that water was coming from, if they had had an inkling that the sill was damaged, then they would have had a perfect right to say, we're not going to close. We're not going to perform. We're not. This contract is over. We're pulling out. So the fact that they were induced to go ahead and close on this transaction and pay the purchase price and take the deed to the property is as much a concealment that induces them, the argument having been made that the concealments and the misrepresentation induced the original signing. Inducing the closing is the same thing. And as far as the damage to the...
Counsel,
yes.
The issue of whether it was part of the contract, the addendum that required them to find the water damage
yes.
and repair it, why isn't that a breach of contract under McDevitt?
Because under those cases, those two cases, RMC and I think it's McDevitt, but in one of those cases, we have a construction contract, and the builder is performing, and the builder builds something defectively. And he has an obligation on the contract to build in good workmanlike fashion. He represents to the owner that he has made the correction, and the owner makes a payment. Well, the duty to make that correction arose only under the contract. The duty to abstain from misrepresenting and defrauding these people did not arise under the contract. That is an independent tort. The other case is where the builder represented that he had built something as opposed to correcting something, which he was obligated to build under the contract, and had not built it. And so, again, that representation had to do with performance of a duty that arose only under the contract.
But the duty here was to find and repair the water damage. They said, we found it, we repaired it. Why isn't that a breach of contract?
Because the duty is to refrain from misrepresenting and concealing to these purchasers to induce them to close on this transaction. That is an independent tort. That is not a duty that's created by the contract.
Counsel, was the contract incorporated in the deed in this particular transaction?
It was not. I do not believe it.
Was it merged into the deed by operation of law?
To the extent that if it was, it wouldn't subsume the duties that the defendant owed to the plaintiffs to abstain from misrepresenting and concealing. With regard to the advertisements, I agree with your question that do we really even need to get to whether my folks were entitled to rely on those advertisements, because the concealment concerning the sill and the misrepresentation concerning the ceiling alone, standing alone, are more than adequate to support the relief that the court afforded my clients.
Why doesn't the case that says you look up, you see the roof is repaired, you have a duty to ask what's going on with the roof? Why didn't your clients have a similar duty? They're looking at two layers of siding that's different from the rest of the house. Why didn't they have a duty to inquire, why'd you replace the siding?
Well, their duty is to have adequate inspections, and the testimony at trial was that a reasonable inspection does not include demolition. In other words, an inspector can't take the siding off and look and see what's under. It's not required to do that. And so I don't think the law requires a purchaser who simply sees that something has been repaired and go and say, why did you repair this? There might have been a number of things. There were some corner boards that had been replaced on this house. And I don't think the law is, I will respond by saying, I don't think the law requires a purchaser who has inspections and whose inspections come back and say there's nothing about this house that would keep you from purchasing it, and specifically said, for instance, there's specifically looked at the sill and found nothing wrong with it, that there's no requirement in the law that a purchaser then have to go back and say, well, why did you repair A, B, C, D? Why did you put a new dishwasher in? Why is this receptacle replaced down here in the kitchen floor? That sort of thing. It could be endless. So I simply don't think that the law requires a purchaser to ask, why did you make a repair? As with regard to the advertisements themselves, Tate against Colony House Builders found that a statement that the new dwelling was, quote, free from structural defects was a representation of the present quality and character of the building. And the representation here that the foundation had been restored was a representation that what holds this house up has been restored. And clearly it had not. Not only not restored, but the fact that it was deteriorated had been hidden.
Counsel, let me ask a question about the remedy. Rescission. How do you get to rescission when the court has found that the other property owner has not defrauded anyone or done anything wrong?
That is actually, I think, the issue in the next appeal, but...
Okay, I'll hold it. Go ahead.
As far as the consequential damage issue goes, let me back up. The measure damage issue. Counsel argues that the measure damages should have been the change in value. Typical cases that Bershader Prospect Development case where the folks bought a home and it was a lot next door and it's represented, nobody's going to build on it. Then they did. They denuded it of trees and they said, we've been defrauded and the cost of replacing the trees is what they awarded. And on appeal, this court said, no, it's the loss in value. But those are cases where you sued for compensatory damages in an action at law for fraud. In rescission, a successful plaintiff who proves fraud is entitled to consequential damages. The cases that counsel has talked about, like Millboro, that's a case, yes. It said that the profits had to be returned, but it doesn't say that consequential damages could not be recovered. In fact, and I cited this in the brief, the Costello Treatise specifically says that consequential damages can be recovered in an action for rescission.
But counsel, in this instance, the consequential damages really flow from the transaction itself. Those expenses would have been incurred if there had been no allegation of fraud, with the exception of the attorney's fees, which flow from the alleged fraud. Is that correct?
That is.
So, with that distinction in mind, how can one receive damages for costs that one would have incurred had they been perfectly happy with their house?
Because in order to restore the status quo, to put them in the position they would have been in, if the truth had been known, they would have closed. They wouldn't have owned the property. They wouldn't have spent all this money.
Doesn't the rescission do that?
Yes,
doesn't the rescission and the attorney's fees put them in the status quo ante?
It doesn't reimburse them the expenses they have incurred because of the ownership of this property, which they wouldn't have had, but for the
They
property.
Would have had expenses to own any property of this value. If they had bought another house for $590,000, if they had been an identical house but without any flaws, they would have incurred those expenses.
They would, and then they've gotten the benefit of their bargain. And there would be no attempt to necessity to restore the status quo.
But can you get the benefit of the bargain and the rescission?
No, you can't. But when you have rescission and you get consequential damages, those are the damages to put you back where you were. You're not getting the benefit of the bargain. You're just getting put back where you were before you got into the bargain.
And that's where the attorney's fees would come in.
And the consequential damage.
Okay. I understand your answer.
Let me ask you this. Assuming your client was not entitled to rescission, what damages would he be entitled to otherwise? Or are you asking for anything other than rescission if you can't do rescission?
The case was tried on rescission.
Okay.
We elected rescission and not the action at law for damages. If we had gone forward with damages, then the measure of damages would have been the loss in value.
So what would happen if we believe rescission was an improper remedy? In this particular instance, does it go back for evidence concerning other damages, or is the case over?
I think it would go back.
At what point was the election made?
It was fairly early in the case. In fact, it was before the matter was referred to the commissioner, if I remember correctly. I see I just have a few minutes left. I would like to talk about the assignments of cross error, if I may. And I'm going to mix back and forth between punitive damages and VCPA because they are related. This court has heard four cases where there was an allegation below of that we're entitled to rescission and punitive damages, and it's never come before this court as to whether punitive damages can be recovered in rescission. But there's never been a suggestion that they can't. The two cases that they talk about, Caudill was a cause of action for personal injuries. It says that cause of action for personal injuries arises when, for breach of warranty, arises when the accident occurs and not when the product is sold. And then Dabney is a case where the one date of notice to the insurer was alleged and another date of notice was proved. And those were pleading problems, which we simply don't have here. Counsel says in the brief, and I quote, that Gask v. Moore's Motor, quote, volunteers that punitive damages and rescission cases are not available. Well, that's not correct. That was a revocation of acceptance case under the Uniform Commercial Code. And, of course, if you're under the Commercial Code, you're dealing in a contractual context, and the folks were awarded punitive damages below, and this court said no. That is an action under contract that's UCC. You can't get punitive damages under those circumstances. That is simply not a ruling that punitive damages are not available in a rescission case.
But the court finally concluded not to award them as within its discretion, correct?
I'm sorry?
The court's final decision not to award punitive damages, originally he said it conflicted, but at the final analysis he said that he just was not going to award them. Wasn't that a matter of discretion?
No, that isn't what happened. The commissioner found willful misrepresentation and concealment.
Right.
And found that the misconduct met the test under the VCPA, and on that basis doubled the consequential damages. Specifically saying that I'm not awarding punitive damages because doubling damages under the VCPA is the equivalent. In this case, this court has decided an automobile case where it essentially said you can't have both because they're duplicate. And that's what the commissioner said. And so the commissioner said, you get VCPA doubling in lieu of punitive. And then the trial court takes the VCPA away saying, it violates the return to status quo principle that is inherent in rescission. And yet, punitives are not awarded, and so you've got this egregious conduct which has not been punished under the circumstances. And so I think it seems to be clear to me that punitive damages are available in rescission. If they're available in rescission, then VCPA ought to be available in rescission, but we're entitled to one or the other. If it's just punitives, this court ought to send it back for assessment of punitive damages. See, my time is up.
All right, thank you. Mr. Maines, you have 2 minutes.
I'm going to begin where my esteemed opposing counsel began, and that is, let's look at the contract. And if you do so, I think that it becomes immediately apparent that the reliance argument advanced by my client must prevail. On page 22 of the appendix, there is a provision in the contract, part of the Disclosure Act, which advises the purchasers that, quote, purchasers should be aware that neither a seller nor a real estate licensee is obligated to disclose facts or occurrences which have an effect on the physical structure of the property. That form goes on to say, the undersigned owners of the real property described above make no representations or warranties as to the condition of the real property or any improvements thereof, and the purchaser will be receiving the property as is, that is, with all defects which may exist. Now,
wasn't there a part of the property disclosure statement, the one that's cut off, and you both admit that it's cut off, and I quite frankly haven't been able to find the cut off part, But I thought the agreement was that that said this did not include misrepresentation.
Well, that was the subject of some emails between opposing counsel and myself in July, and I said that I did not think that they could add that document because I could never find it in the record. And what has happened is they've added it by way of the printer. They simply attached it, an unsigned copy. But if we focus on that, the final paragraph says, it's very, very clear, if a purchaser gets a disclaimer form, which is what they got here, they lose their right to rescission, either at settlement or occupancy. So the very document they rely upon does
where,
not support.
Where in that document, Counselor, is that language? I'll find it. I don't want you to use your time looking for it. I'll find it.
Your Honor, but it is on the very, the and I'll be page 102 of their exhibit, which comes after page 40. The last paragraph, the very first sentence, the purchaser who receives the disclaimer statement loses the right to terminate the contract upon settlement or occupancy. And the language that they represent or look to has to do with when a purchaser has received a disclosure statement, not a disclaimer statement. That's all I had. I would like to have some additional time, but I didn't
know that. No, you're way over the time.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. You were just answering the court's question, which you're not only entitled to do, you have to do. Thank you for your argument. Call the next case.